This is Christian Robillard, and you're listening to Beyond the Bake Sale, where we help you raise more time, talent, and treasure in innovative, creative, and effective ways for the causes you care about. On this episode, I spoke with Tom Ahern. Tom is considered one of North America's leading authorities on donor communications. Tom works with dozens of clients nationwide every year. They include brand names like the Sierra Club and Save the Children, as well as hospitals, universities, foundations, and local charities. He specializes in bequest marketing, donor communications evaluations, direct mail, newsletter interventions, and case statements for big ticket campaigns. Each year, he delivers dozens of workshops on the techniques of and psychology behind effective fundraising communications. He is also the author of 4 well-received books. Tom is also an award-winning magazine journalist for articles on health, women's rights, and other social justice issues. He has his MA and BA in English from Brown University and a certificate in advertising art from the Rhode Island School of Design. In our conversation, we discussed how fundraising is all about activity, why now, why us, why anyone would care, and how nonprofits and charities need authenticity now more than ever. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Tom, welcome to the show. It's great to visually see you and your impressive office setup.
Oh, thank you, Christian. You might be able to see, this is audio, so the viewer doesn't see it, right? But if the viewer could, what they'd see is over 500 how-to books on my shelves, which basically, as a freelance copywriter, marketing copywriter first, now fundraising copywriter, you always say yes when somebody brings you an assignment, and then you find a book as fast as possible that will tell you how to actually do it.
It's amazing how a $30 to $50 book can help you, whether it's land or be able to deliver on thousands of dollars worth of client work. Have you ever hit a job before where you haven't found a book that that has been able to help you deliver on that in particular?
Well, it's interesting you'd bring that up, because there were books missing that I needed and they just didn't exist. And one of them was a book about how to write a fundraising case, the case for support, which underlies pretty much everything. Like, if you're going to send out a direct mail appeal or an e-appeal, or you're going to have a website and a giving page, all of them need to have a case for support beneath it. And what you'd normally find is a book about campaigns, because they were conventionally associated cases with capital campaigns. And so there'd be a book about how to run a capital campaign. And you'd get to the end of chapter 3, and it would say, and you must have a case for support. And then you'd go to chapter 4, and it would start with, now that you have your case for support. And it was like, no, where's chapter 3.5? That's the one I need, the one that tells me how to write the darn thing. And so I did get training in cases. I worked for 2 different big consulting firms, Jerry Panis's firm out of Chicago and another firm that's all kind of all over the world now called Martz & Lundy. And they trained me in cases, and they trained me by sending me cases that they had written, and I would deconstruct them and do things like, okay, the first section has this many words in it and it's about this thing, and then the next section is this many words and it's about this thing, and so forth. And that's how I learned. But I finally thought, well, I'll just write the book myself. And so I did, and that was one of my early books, was Seeing Through a Donor's Eyes, and that book was about cases. And I'm now have just finished and submitted to the publisher the second edition of that book, much expanded to cover things, because, for instance, annual reports could be seen as a case for support. It would be helpful if people did see it that way, because it would give that annual report much more utility over time.
Especially if you're able to pull certain excerpts of it, or even throughout the year as you're delivering on certain accountability products, you're almost taking all of those things together and putting them into your annual report. So it makes it almost easier for you, where you're almost piecing it together as you go on throughout the year, instead of at the end being like, oh, I guess we have to assemble all of these things now and start to scramble to a certain degree.
Yeah, and the case for support tends to, it allows the thing that charities will kind of conventionally or instinctively do, which is to give you information, data, results, you know, how many people did we serve and so forth. But it also forces you to think about how am I going to inspire a donor, a prospect, a supporter potentially, to care, to join this family of doing good. One of the easiest training I got in case writing was from Martin Lundy, from a wonderful guy there who's the head of their communications group and a former journalist, and he, Ron Arena is his name, and he took me out to lunch when he recruited me for Martin Lundy and said, look, cases are really, I think, just come down to answering three big questions. Why now? Why us? And why would anyone care? And that, so the last question is actually, why would you, the donor, care about this thing we do? And that's a rich, rich mine to explore. But in fact, because of human nature, really, all you need to do is say, well, we need you. And you're kind of done, at least with a preliminary. We need you. And it doesn't have to be more complicated than that. The three questions, why us, that's where you get to talk about how wonderful your program is, or your charity, or your mission, and how capable you are, and all that. And then the why now is the urgency factor. And the urgency factor always plays a role in fundraising, because if you're a donor, you have 100 charities coming to your door, and you'll be able to respond to 10. And so how do you triage that that incredible need that's out there in the world? In some ways, the coronavirus crisis has revealed how much need this world has, and that the status quo is always more fragile than we believe and understand and accept, and that who's going to take care of these problems? Well, governments play a role, but governments have also failed us, I think, in many estimations. And nonprofits play an increasing role, and that's obvious because if you look at the growth of the nonprofit industry, and I'm aware of the United States mostly because I live there, the nonprofit sector now is the third largest employer in the United States, and I believe it is the same in other countries like yours, Canada, and so forth. And it has exploded. The number of charities in the United States is now over 1.5 million charities. And some of them are not what you'd call normal helping other people charities. They're more like associations or something. But many of them are set up to solve some kind of problem, or at least try to solve some kind of problem. And the problems are multiplying.
And in terms of some of the comms that you're starting to see, you know, you talk about how you might, in this particular time, more so than others, you might get those 100 requests where you can only provide, let's say, support to 10. Out of those requests that you're starting to see come out or have seen come out in this crisis, are there ones that represent like the good, some that represent like the bad, and some that represent the ugly? Maybe one or two per that that you might be willing to talk through in a, whether it's high level or getting as specific as you want.
Yeah, well, the first answer to that is we study success. Now, success is not, oh, I like it. That's irrelevant. What is relevant in fundraising is, did it work? Did it bring in cash? Did it bring in support? If I'm looking for volunteers, did we get some? How strong was the engagement? You know, if it's a like an email or something, you can, there are metrics. Open rates, click-through rates, and so forth that tell us, are people paying attention? Are people engaging? Are people doing something? Because fundraising is about activity. It's not about information. It's not about telling people something. It's about getting them to do something. And that, getting them out of their inertia, which is, I think, the number one problem in fundraising problem, I mean, obstacle, is that it's much easier not to do anything. You know, oh yeah, that's a really bad problem. I'll think about it. Maybe I'll do something tomorrow, is kind of how most people will initially respond. So the communications world, the medium, whatever medium you're using, or whatever device you're using, or delivery system you're using, or channel you're using, all of these have the same kind of set of simple hurdles you have to get over. The first one being, you have to get my attention. So the first gift I give you is not my money. It's far from that. The first gift I give you is some of my rare attention span, which is being chewed up every day by more and more and more and more messaging. And the internet is fabulous, of course, and all the wonderful things it does for us. But what it has also done for us is it's put us in front of this megaphone of advertising and offers that just slams into us all day long. And we, charities, that is, have to survive in that tidal wave, and somehow gain their little bit of my reserved attention, because I don't give it away. You can see this with the reports that come out from M plus R benchmarks, which are an annual, the new one coming out just like in the next couple of weeks. Everybody should download this. They're downloadable free PDFs. Every year it gives you, it's about digital fundraising, and it is very thorough. And one of the things that was quite clear over the last few years is that people are really tired of email. They get so much of it, and so much of it is boring and repetitive. So the answer, you know, for many charities is we don't want to take any chances, because we don't want to offend anyone, because that person could have maybe given us a gift. That kind of thinking brings you to a dead end. That's where the boring people end up.
And in terms of getting people's attention now more so than ever, is there anything that's different now under these conditions? Or again, there's an undue strain on the system, and there's a lot of, I guess, there's a lot more competition even, or even a similar level of competition to get people's attention, and then ultimately to get those gifts in the door, or that support. Is there anything that's different now under kind of COVID-19 times in terms of some of those communications that are coming out?
Oh, definitely. Well, for one thing, and I was surprised to discover this, because as we had talked earlier, I said I've been for the last 3 weeks or more pretty much doing nothing but coronavirus-related fundraising, either webinars trying to teach people about how to talk to their donors, their supporter base during this crisis, and or going out into my big network of experts around the world and asking them what the heck's happening. You know, what are you doing? What's working? What should we be afraid? How afraid should we be? And that is, of course, in fundraising terms, being afraid of the disease. Well, that's reasonable. But the surprise was that charities actually were making more money right now during this crisis than they were during the same period a year earlier. So usually, I mean, we're in the crisis kind of came to full bloom in March, and now we're into April. And the this is not the giving season, at least in the Western world. Usually that season is your October, November, December, sometimes into January. That's the peak of giving. Now, that doesn't mean you go silent during the rest of the year, but you don't expect a terrific return. Now, the coronavirus has really sharpened the pencil for a lot of people in terms of, I get it, you know, there is a need here. And we are going, if we can, I mean, this is there was research done by Blue Frog, Mark Phillips, over in the UK, and they talk to donors all the time, his agency, to see where they are, you know, emotionally and in their behaviors. And what they've discovered is that if you do not feel financially pinched, you haven't stopped giving. In fact, if anything, you're giving more. And particularly, you're responsive to anything that is related to the impact of coronavirus. And Mark is very smart about the psychological underpinnings of this. And what he said, basically, people feel out of control right now. They don't, you know, their life has been turned upside down. Everything is different. Nobody knows how it's going to end, which, of course, was the same case in 2008 and then the year 2000. And then, you know, this is a cyclical issue. It's just what the cause is different each time. But so we're at the very beginning of this. How's it going to turn out? And people feel out of control and they don't like that. That's an uncomfortable feeling. And so in some ways, if you can give your donors, your prospects, your supporters something to do where they can feel that they are, in fact, in even a little bit in control, that they are doing something useful, give them purpose, as always, then they tend to be responsive. Now, the one thing I've learned is that you really have to tailor your appeal. You can't be, I totally indifferent to the fact that out of 12 news stories every day, 11 of them have the word coronavirus in the headline. So you have to really be in that world, because that's the world we're all in right now. And give me something to do.
How do you have the appropriate balance between obviously paying attention that these are, I think the word unprecedented has been used probably more than most people would care to admit. Being like acknowledging that this is an unprecedented time and an abnormal time, and, you know, having almost unique needs, but also not overdoing it on that particular piece of not overusing the unprecedented, the abnormal, paying reference to that too much. Is there a happy balance or a good balance that you've been able to see or that you've paid attention to?
Happy balance? No, I wouldn't say anything about this is going to be happy. And I think we have to accept that. When people ask that, and this isn't just during this crisis, Christian, people will often say when I'm teaching, their hand will go up and can we overdo the whatever it is, you know, use of the word you, can we overdo thanking? Can we overdo flattery? And what they're really saying is, I don't like it. I don't want to do it. Can please let me off the hook? And the answer is no, you can't overdo it. You can't overdo it. You can't overdo it. And the same with unprecedented and urgent. I'm not letting you off this hook. You have to talk about this stuff. And you are uncomfortable about that. And that's part of, this is part of the professionalization of the nonprofit world. The stuff that insiders are uncomfortable about are the very things that actually work to raise more money. So if you're feeling uncomfortable and you're an insider, that's probably a good sign. And your board chair, and this has been coming up the last week, oh, we shouldn't ask for money right now because it's, you know, everybody's got other things on their mind. No, 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 and no. This is when you reach out to your base and say, if you can, because you're aware that people may have lost their jobs or whatever, be somewhere not good financially, but if you can, here's something you can do right now that's important, and then you make your offer to them. Let's not forget that most being about 50% of donors in the United States and Canada are 65 and older, which means their financial position in life probably is stable. They may have already retired and be living off whatever, you know, pension or in our country, Social Security, or their savings or their investments or whatever. But they're not pinched. What they are is bored, and they're, you know, we're all stuck in this limbo, wondering, oh my Lord, you know, another day. I mean, it's gotten so. I made a mistake on my calendar because I got a week ahead. You know, I thought, oh, I've got this webinar this afternoon at 3 p.m. And it turned out it was a week from now. But time has become kind of, you know, this elastic thumb.
Oh, it's so true. So going back to that piece around whether it's board chairs or even some leadership saying, you know, maybe like this doesn't seem like the right or the appropriate time per those, some of those sensitivities that you flagged around. Well, maybe people have lost their job or they've lost investment income, whatever that might be. How do you overcome something like that? How do you get past that and get into, you know, we do still need to fundraise. We do still need to talk to folks. We need to, and obviously incorporating certain sensitivities. How do you get past that no or that resistance in the first place?
Well, I have a different position than a lot of people. Like fundraisers are one of the beaten down classes, I think. they're often second guessed by bosses who, you know, have authority, so they're allowed to second guess. Not that they have necessarily training or understanding, they just have hunches and opinions. And I don't actually deal with that in my own world as a consultant, because I don't accept clients who act that way. We have a little discussion at the beginning, and the basic question from me to them is, are you going to let me do the work, or are you going to second guess me? And if you're going to second guess me, then see you later. People who have a job and a salary that depends on pleasing the boss, they don't have that luxury. And I didn't either for a long time, but I got to the point where people said, well, we want you. And then I could say, well, then are you the people, do I want you? This communications in a crisis, I'm looking at the show that I just have been working on pretty much daily now for weeks, because I keep showing it to new audiences. Yesterday I showed it to a group called Teach for America, which is down clearly in America, and they're doing fundraising. This is not their usual time of year to make a ton of money, but they and they're wondering what to do. And of course, all the schools have closed, and so these were teachers. Now they're doing virtual teaching, distance learning, and they're wondering, what do we say to our public? What do we say to the people that care about us, part of our supporter family? And I think the first thing is you do need to think of them as part of your supporter family. It is, what would you do, you know, if what are you doing right now with your own family? What are you doing? You're calling, you're saying, how's it going? What's happening at your end? You know, what do you see out there? The nasty brutish side of fundraising, brutish side is that it's all about the money. And that is, that's a form of ignorance. It's not at all, in fact, about the money. Fundraising is about 15 million years of brain evolution that results in a gift if you connect with something that's already in the brain of the supporter. And so the reason you have people worried, is this the right time to ask, is that they never really thought about their donors as a family. They just thought about them as a wallet.
So then what are some of those, I guess, columns are obviously, when they're done well, are always a bit of a two-way communication. So what are some of those things that charities and nonprofits now can be doing in addition to some of those phone calls to have that two-way communication, to touch base with some of their supporters to say, how are you doing? Are there things that we can be helping with? What would be your advice around something like that?
Yeah, well, here are some of the things I collected, Christian, and I've got a PowerPoint up so I can remind myself. When the crisis was just starting to roll out, I get a lot of good information. If you don't already follow people on Twitter who are professional people, experts, gurus, whatever, you might want to. It's where I get most of my great information these days, is off Twitter. And one person there, Angela McBride, was saying, our team sent simple brief emails to check in with donors. Lots of responses, some very long. People crave care and connection. So that's a verbatim tweet from her. And what you're trying to do, and this I get from Jen Chang, who's a psychologist who specializes in philanthropic behavior, in the study of that, she's saying, look, right now people feel, and these are her words, paralyzed, confined, victimized, disarmed, and powerless. And those are bad feelings. Those are uncomfortable feelings. Those are feelings we want to escape. She said, one of the things charity can do at this point in time is help people feel connected, help them feel cared for. So you're going, again, you know, use the metaphor of the family. You're going to your supporter family. We're all in this trying to get one thing done. That's the mission. And you're going to say to them, well, these are bad times. These are crazy times. And how is it going for you? And just listen to them and don't have your hand out right away. And I've got a lovely piece here. Thank you. I shouldn't say thank you. It's an email that was sent by a group I support. So I'm a donor to this group. It's called Soul, S-O-L-E, like the sole of your foot, Hope. And they work in Uganda, and they essentially put shoes on people so they don't get diseases through their feet, right? And they sent an email recently, and the subject line said, how are you? And that was it, question mark. How are you? And it opens with a quote, nicely done graphically, but very simple, from Desmond Tutu. And it says, hope is being able to see that there is light despite all of the darkness. And it just kind of lifted me. It lifts you. And it's like, oh, thanks for that reminder. And then it's personalized. The first paragraph, and this is the entire paragraph, Tom, we wanted to reach out and connect with you during this difficult and uncertain time. Period. New paragraph. We hope everyone in your family is doing well. We know a lot of businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And then they go into a couple of little sections. One is labeled, we are all in this together. And they start with, as for Soul Hope, here's a high-level view of how things are going for us. And they then do a bullet list. And then you're now in the know. The importance of our work remains. So they remind you of that. So they haven't gone out of business. Business changed a bit, but they haven't gone out. And then they finally say, gratefully yours, Jan and the Soul Hope team. And that's it. Notice, no ask. Now, this is the conventional wisdom, and wisdom and conventional probably shouldn't be put together in the same phrase, but it is true that if you 6 months ago asked pretty much any fundraising agency, the expensive people that most charities can't afford to work with, should you always ask for a gift no matter what communications you're sending, most of them would have by default said, yeah, probably. It's probably a good thing to do. You never know. There's money out there. People, may be at the right point where they just feel generous. But now is different. Now is not 6 months ago. So I have Soul Hope sending me something here, which is totally about me and them together in this time of crisis. And that's all it's about. It's not asking for money. If you haven't done that yet, charities, then I'm not even going to say you're missing an opportunity. I'm going to say you aren't living up to my expectations as a donor.
And really not to, from what I've seen at least, or from what we've talked about so far, you're really not treating them like they're part of that family as well. You're treating them very much like it's a continual ATM and you're just good for us for the cash, and you're not articulating that you care about us. It's all about you. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but I think that it's when we were talking about some of the groups that are doing that especially well, whether it's right now or in general, I think you mentioned that the results are still coming in or it's still a little bit soon to tell. But are there some groups that you know of that are doing that whole, I guess, that whole holistic side of things, of both the checking in with their donors and their supporters, the making of the asks using the appropriate donor-centric languages or language, things of that nature? Are there some groups that are doing that particularly well now and that are seeing the results come in that ultimately prove it? Because as you said, it's about the results. It's not about whether you like it or not.
Yeah, one of the things I've been doing, as I mentioned, was going out and collecting evidence of, what are you doing, how's it working, and so forth. So, for instance, I had two Bloomerang. If your listeners don't know them, it's a customer relationship CRM, it's customer relationship management software. Yeah, it's
something like that.
Yeah, it's mainly for smaller organizations, although that would be anybody with 500 or fewer employees. It's really a lot of organizations fall into that bucket. But they know, because they have about 8,000 clients that use Bloomerang, what people are making, because it's all cloud-based and they have all the data that's coming into the company Bloomerang every day, and they are able to analyze it. So what they discovered was, during this period, I'm reading from a post by them, that overall, Bloomerang customers that sent fundraising appeals raised $1.35 million more during this COVID crisis period than they did during the same time period last year. And that's interesting. Now, the same period last year was not, as I pointed out before, the giving season. So it's really kind of off the peak. But this crisis, again, if you have not been damaged financially, has heightened the awareness of, we're all in this together. Yeah, there are things that have to get done. Yeah. And so in some ways, it's how do you relate to the crisis? So for instance, and Bloomerang has a couple of case studies that are free and available on their website. But two of them I particularly focused on. One, they canceled an event. It was their 27th annual fundraiser for something called the Naperville Education Foundation. And what these education foundations do is they raise money in the United States, at least for public school systems, particularly that have a lot of at-risk kids and have a lot of extra needs that aren't covered by budgets and taxes. And they raise money from the community in order to provide extra programming, sometimes provide meals to kids that may not be getting enough good, nutritious food, et cetera, et cetera. It's all good. It's easy to understand. And they couldn't have their event, you know, because it's illegal now. You can't get together. Sorry. And this was going to be their 27th. So the first thing they send out is an email that canceled it, you know, and they point out that the goal had been to raise $100,000. It was the big annual thing. They're going to raise $100,000. So there's a donate button prominent in the middle of that email. And then they sent out another email, which described this new crisis fund. And the crisis fund, it's kind of an iteration of what they were doing every year. It is for the kids who are most at risk and so forth. But because of we're having this crisis, because schools are closed, because these at-risk kids are no longer in that nurturing environment, they may be home, they may not be eating, et cetera, et cetera. They've now linked it to the coronavirus. And then the day of the event, so it's the very same day that would have happened if we could have had an event, they did a virtual event. And they did it using, you know, little videos and little things. It wasn't exorbitantly elaborate, but they did it on the same day. They reinforced it with other emails. And what that happened was, because they were able to no longer have the expenses associated with putting on an event in a facility where there was food and so forth, they were able to net much more money. So they actually went way over goal. They netted over 100,000, whereas if they had had the event, they would have only netted about 75,000 out of the total goal. And that wasn't the only we canceled the event and we went over goal. So, you know, sometimes these crises is like, oh my gosh, that's our big event. What are we going to do? Well, you know, maybe people are a little bored. Maybe they'd rather not go to your event. In fact, unevents have been kind of a fun thing in the last few years. We'll send us money and you won't have to go. Oh, thank you. Here's a lot of money. I'd love not to go. There are other things that are happening now. People are adjusting, they're improvising, they're trying stuff. I have an emergency e-appeal template that was taught by Stephen Screen. He's part of the Better Fundraising Company, which is based in Seattle. Very good group, very successful, works heavily with smaller nonprofits again. And he teaches, in fact, it's available for free online, an emergency e-appeal template. And I talked to three different people that used it. So they watched his little video. It's only about 6 minutes long. And they followed his instructions. It's got 8 steps. And sent it out, praying, hoping for the best. And just saw amazing results. One, a senior living ministry down in San Antonio, they were trying to raise $22,000 in order to install a new high-speed internet system in every living unit so that people wouldn't feel isolated. I mean, they do feel isolated, but if you have plenty of streaming and content and stuff like that, then not so much. And also, because these are seniors and they have health issues, it was going to be telemedicine as well. And in 24 hours with this email, they raised half their goal. In the next 24 hours, they raised the other half to 22,000. That was in 48 hours. And then another person, again, a senior. So in some ways, you can hear what's the word that matters here? Well, it's senior, because we know that seniors, so-called, are in the high-risk group from the coronavirus. education. Schools are closed. Okay, that's a problem. We got to do something about it. So this other senior center down in Florida, she sent out her appeal, and she also her e-appeal. She backed it up with a direct mail appeal, and then a donor, one of her major donors, said, "Hey, you know, I will match up to $50,000. I'll give you a chance to do a matching offer," and she raised $100,000 within, you know, a couple of days. Now, what happens? All of these appeals have words like unprecedented in them, urgent, uncertain times, all of this. But what, because the appeal, this formula, this template is very specific, and is about the times we live in, people are responsive to that specificity. Will you get complaints? Yes, you will. And you're going to have to learn to deal with complaints, because complaints are part of the real world of customer service. We, you know, you can't please everybody all the time. I forget who said it. But anyway, so yes, you'll get complaints, because everybody takes this differently. Somebody's going to call or write or email and chew you out for, why would you be raising money during these times right now? Somebody's going to find that offensive. Guess what? That's life. That's real life. And you know, the worry with charities is, well, we don't want to offend anyone. They might be a donor. Yeah, they might. But you can't be, you will not get to your goal by being bland. At least you will get there fast. If you're totally bland, you just won't win the attention race, for one thing. And you should be able to deal with objections. Objections are nothing. Direct mail professionals are trained to expect complaints. And if they don't get them, they actually see that as a failure, because it must mean that we offended, that we didn't push hard enough, and therefore didn't trigger any offense. And it isn't that everybody loved you, it's that everybody ignored you.
Yeah, and there's two things that come to mind when you're talking about that particular example. One is from an icon a number of years ago with Adrian Sargent, talking about how, I don't remember the exact numbers, but in terms of people felt better if they had a chance and a portal to complain about your actual organization from a customer relationship perspective, versus, and even if you didn't do anything about that, just the fact they had an option to complain and say that, or see that someone actually heard them was powerful for them in terms of their affinity towards the organization. And then it proceeded to get better as you actually did something about it, or said why you didn't do something about it, or made a certain decision. And I think the second part is from our mutual friend, Sam LaPrade, talking about how if someone's willing to pick up the phone and call you and say that something bothers them, it means that they care so much about your cause. And that should be a point of pride to a certain degree. And it's just, you know, the fact that it's not every single message is going to resonate with every single person, and that's okay. And that feedback helps with re-engaging that person, or just engaging that person at a different point in time with that unique piece of information.
Yeah. Right now, authenticity is so important. And authenticity is not sounding like an institution, but sounding like a real human. And I think a lot of times charities, they'll hide behind this veneer. For instance, the veneer of jargon. You know, we have this language, we're dealing with at-risk kids and things like that. The jargon protects them.
Yeah.
But nobody's escaping this. And we need to come out from behind these various masks and shields and costumes and, you know, armor, and say we're vulnerable too, because that is going to resonate emotionally with people. I talked to a consultant who's a copywriter, a very good fundraiser named Amy Vance down in Tennessee, and she has four things that she's focused on right now with her clients. She said, you have to talk with empathy, transparency, vulnerability, and boldness. And it was the last one that kind of shook me, because it's rare to meet a charity that will speak with boldness. They want to kind of hide in a corner and please just give us some money.
Yeah, not step on anyone's toes. So, what's an example of speaking with boldness then? Just if you have a tangible example or one that you've come across that you're like, yeah, that's bold, but I'm in favor of it. Well,
I think charities misunderstand bold to mean loud, noisy, offensive. It isn't. It is merely to, in some ways, it's merely not to be the stereotype. If you're not the stereotype, then you're different. And that means, that means you may win the attention race and somebody's going to pay more attention to you because you are different. One of the real problems is that all charities kind of look alike. You know, we unfortunately, I'll get to that. We all borrow from the same ideas of how do you go about doing this. So you have events, you write grants, you send out direct mail, you send out email, you have a website with a donate button. Everybody has a donate button. So, you know, it's like we are all doing exactly the same thing. And when you get to the industrial scale fundraising where you've got some agency doing this for you, well, you know, you could pretty much strip the logo off and you wouldn't be able to tell one charity from the other. That is not how you win the attention race. That's how you lose. So bold can, you interpret it however you want. What I would say is if it makes you uncomfortable, then you're probably going in the right direction.
With obviously some considerations, I think you can use your common sense to think about, oh, this makes me uncomfortable, but probably not in the way that I'm hoping for or the way that we're intending.
Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, so I'm looking at an example. This is from the Animal Rescue League of Boston, Christian, and they adopted donor centricity about 5 or 6 years ago, and giving has gone up quite a bit since then. And we're talking, this is a big organization. They've been around for well over 100 years, and they increased giving 40%. With a donor-centered approach versus what they had before. So that's a significant amount of money when you consider, you know, if you're a $100 million a year charity and you go up 40%, that's $40 million extra dollars. That's a lot of money to do good with. And what do they send out? Well, they're thinking about their family. They're thinking about why do people care about puppies and kittens and other, you know, vulnerable creatures. And they send out an email, and the subject line is "Cute Break, Your Virtual Care Package, Part 2. And there's a part 3, and there was a part 1, and there's going to be a part 4. Until the crisis is over, they're going to keep sending this care package of cute, which has, as you can imagine, big pictures of really cute animals. And but not, you know, not stock photography. These are the real animals that they have rescued and the real animals that they have healed because they have some, medical problems. And then they do a little bit of reporting, not a lot. I mean, it's mostly visual, but they have these little stories, a wild rescue you made possible. And tips and tricks for your furry and feathered family members, because, of course, a lot of people who support this have pets and love their pets. And it ends with, thank you for being an unwavering champion for animals in need. We hope you, your loved ones, and furry or feathered friends remain healthy and safe! ! And I mean, I've been with charities who would look at that and go, I know. we don't talk that way. It's like,
yeah, well, that seems too like chummy or even colloquial. That's not formal at all. And that's
goes against our brand. How dare we? You know, we need to hide behind our institutionality. And they abandoned. I mean, I worked with them when they were switching over, and the first battle was okay, guys, it worked for Walt Disney. You've got to put voice balloons on your animals. And the staff, the internal staff, veterinarians, professionals, and so forth, said, no, absolutely no. That is a red line. We do not cross. We do not anthropomorphize. That it is like, I know that makes you feel good, but why do the animals care? And if it made Walt Disney vast fortunes to anthropomorphize animals, why do you think this is going to fail? And it isn't. It's just some attitude you have that you have to get over. And so they did. They now have voice balloons on animals.
I love it. I have a couple last questions for you, Tom, as we start to wrap up a bit of our conversation. The first one being around, I guess, any changes that you've seen in how people have gone about executing on their comms. You know, we've talked a lot about how people are in this fight, this ever raging fight for attention, and how folks ideally are embracing more of that more almost familial and family back and forth with their donors to check in on them, which they should have been doing already. Are there any changes that you've seen in how successful charities and nonprofits have been going about things that you think might be here to stay, as opposed to just here for the time being?
Oh, I think this, first of all, you have to be alert. So if you're not an alert charity, no, nothing's going to change. You're going to go back to doing what you were doing, and you'll go back to getting the same results, if not worse. The charity, this may be the best booster rocket for donor centricity we've had, because this actually is the time for charities to experiment with becoming human, not institutional, and to get used to it. And don't worry about getting it wrong. You're not going to get anything wrong when you're trying to be honest, authentic, vulnerable. People will appreciate that. The distance will close between you and your audience. So I think what you're going to see is perhaps adaptation. What I see is behind the scenes. It hasn't really hit the vast charity world yet, but I'm seeing it with Jen Chang, that psychologist, and the work she's done. They're taking now what is about 15 years of research, Christian, and they're finally leaving the testing, the R&D stage, where they've tested this with various charities in controlled circumstances to see, you know, which word works best, which phrasing works best, which emotion works best, et cetera, et cetera. They're finally leaving that phase and just rolling these things out. And in part because of the coronavirus. The coronavirus has put a lot of charities like Greenpeace Spain, for instance, on high alert. And it's never waste a good crisis. So people that are always going to be innovating, and that would be Greenpeace. Greenpeace, after all, started as a handful of people around a table in Canada back in around 1972. And now it's got millions and millions of supporters who are trying to save the planet and from us, you know. Who's the enemy? We are. And so Greenpeace, but it's always been a leader. They were one of the first people to get into face-to-face street fundraising, et cetera, et cetera. Big into direct mail early on, big into TV early on. Now they're getting big into donor centricity. And they're going to be there first. I've been working with other big groups like Save the Children, the USA for UNHCR people. They're going to be there, and they're going to reap the rewards. And eventually, and I think eventually, without training, eventually it's going to take a while. Eventually, other charities will notice and wonder and imitate and get it wrong. But eventually, maybe with training, get it right. And that's going to be the new thing.
Well, one can only hope. One can only hope. So I guess, Tom, if you were to have the chance, I mean, you're preparing a number of webinars and have been very great, gracious with your time, generous with your time in terms of helping build out this episode and have this conversation. But if you were able to, whether it's for exclusively this particular set of circumstances for rating for fundraising and for donor engagement, or generally speaking, if the same principles would apply, and this might be a bit of repetition from other parts of our conversation, if you were to build a bit of like a masterclass, and perhaps this, again, I think this is something that you're already doing to a degree, but if you were to build a masterclass for comms related to fundraising and donor engagement, either exclusively during this time of COVID-19 coronavirus and fundraising, or generally speaking, what would some of those modules look like? And what would some of those key lessons look like that you hope people walk away from and eventually maybe, or hopefully be able to take into their shops and their work?
Yeah, well, as it happens, and you know, here comes the self-promotion, I'm building an online course for the Institute for Sustainable Philanthropy. It'll be up and running, I promise, in June. That's the deadline. I haven't finished the course yet. And doing online courses, I got to tell you, because I've done it twice now already, is some of the most painful work I have ever attempted. It's complicated. There's a whole new thing that you have to learn about how to teach online. You have to take vast amounts of material and boil them down into kind of, you know, multiple choice questions and stuff. It's painful. And I'm working at it. So it will be there. Institute for Sustainable Philanthropy, coming soon, June.
And we'll, it's going to be... make sure to link that in the show notes for sure.
Yeah. Well, and they're going to offer a certificate. So the certificate will be in what is called PhilPsych, which is short for Psychology of Philanthropy. And it's all the stuff that for 15 years or so, Jen Chang and Adrian Sargent have been researching, now put to frontline use, put out into the world. We've done, the testing's done. Here's what we've discovered. And here's how you use it as a copywriter. So it's going to be very pragmatic. It's going to be very practical. I'm the writer in residence for this, but the science is all behind it. And it's going to teach you the principles of this. And they're fascinating, actually. You know, the thing is, the suspicion was, and it was Ken Burnett who introduced this back in the 1990s, was that so-called relationship fundraising was going to produce more revenue. And as opposed to industrial direct mail and so forth, which was the kind of the, you know, how the big boys did it. And there were people that believed that and people who didn't. But Ken was, you know, a high performer in fundraising. He had an agency, one of the bigger ones in the UK. And so people gave him the benefit of the doubt. The research wasn't quite there yet, but it all started to become there back in the early 2000s. Penelope Burke published her book. Adrian Sargent published his book with Jen and some other books. And the Institute for Sustainable Philanthropy came along, did all sorts of other research out in the field. Nobody really realizes has been done. It's been 10 years of figuring stuff out. And the bottom line for all of it, Christian, was always the same. We made a ton more money when we switched from institutional-based to donor-centered. And charities, mostly 95% that I see, are still in the institutional-based. They're back in the 1990s. They have no idea that they could make twice as much money just by talking differently to the very same people using the very same things they do. They don't need shiny new things. What they need is to stop talking the way they did talk and start talking the way that we now know how to talk.
Especially with something that's grounded in actual facts and data and not just opinions and hunches, as I think we've talked about quite a few times. As much as we'd love to, you know, base things off of hunches and gut feelings forever, now that we actually have data to back up and reinforce these things, it's like, hallelujah, finally.
Hallelujah, finally, absolutely.
Or eventually, maybe, one of those two.
Eventually, yes. There are going to be winners and there are going to be people that don't get it. So,
Absolutely. So, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. Wondering if there's anything aside from the course that'll be coming out soon that you'd like to share with our audience that you're working on, or things or ways that people can follow and keep up to date with what it is that that you're doing.
Yeah, well, thank you, actually, for that invitation, Christian. What I would suggest is subscribe, it's free, to my e-newsletter, which comes out when I feel like it, but pretty regularly. plus, you'll get plenty of advertising from me for things, but things that are worthwhile. I don't do junk. And but what it's really about, it's a kind of ongoing how-to seminar, and it's all these stuff that I'm learning, because I have 1,000 mentors, and I'm learning pretty much every day something new and amazing that that I share out through this e-newsletter. So if you go to my website, which is www.ahernc.com, Ahern spelled A-H-E-R-N, then you'll find me. And you can subscribe. Perfect. It's right there at the very top of the homepage.
Love it. And we'll make sure we link that in the show notes as well as a number of the other resources and brilliant people that we've had in our conversation today. So really grateful again for all the wisdom you've distilled onto us, Tom. I feel like, mentally speaking, I've added probably 10 or 15 books from that back rack of 500 in just our sit down. And hope you and your loved ones stay well. And thank you for all your contributing.
Well, thank you, Christian, for doing all this. It's a great service you do.
Hey, everyone. Christian here with a few short things before you take off. A big thanks for tuning into another episode of Beyond the Bake Sale. Did you love the episode? Then we'd be grateful for a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Don't want to miss our next episode? Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Want to collaborate on something? Have a story that you want to tell? Have feedback for us? Then shoot us a message by heading to our website at www.btbs.ca. While you're there, you can follow us on social, read our blog, and also listen to past episodes. But above all, thank you for committing to moving beyond the bake sale.